Hi, I'm Jenny, and I'm at Prentice Women's Hospital, and I just had a baby. And you're listening to Outside the Loop Radio, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It's wonderful to be here with you today for show number 981. And what we do here on the program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer on duty today in the WGN radio studio. He's fresh from Lollapalooza. He's in his jorts and his cutoff shirt. We love Fergie. And on the show today, we hear from the author of a book called Chicago Before the Fire, taking a look at the history of the city before the Great Chicago Fire. And we talked to a staff writer at The Reader who recently wrote about the resurgence of CDs, compact discs. So I thought, hey, compact discs, who should I bring in here for a few minutes? You heard her voice to start the show. My wife, Jenny, is here. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, happy anniversary, because yesterday was our 16th wedding anniversary, 16 years of me being a perfect husband.
The sweet 16. Yeah. Happy anniversary.
Yeah, thanks. I'm glad you just let that perfect husband thing go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard that joke
before. Yeah, it's not my finest material. But I made you, I guess, 17, 19 years ago now, I made you a mix CD.
Yes.
So instead of a mixtape, I did the mixed CD, and we're talking about the resurgence of CDs today. Now, that I think that did it, because here we are.
Right. Yeah, that was it.
that was the closer. I don't know today, like, if I made you, if we were dating, a mix Spotify playlist, would that kind of be the same thing?
No, because I think, well, and so a mixed CD and then, like, the mixed tape before it, like the predecessor, the thing that was so special about that and why I think it made such a impact is that it took a lot of time and effort to create one of those. And so it wasn't, to your point, just like a Spotify list where you like do a couple clicks and there it is and you can put it out into the world for anybody to follow. It was like specially curated for me by you, and you put a lot of thought into like the song selection.
And it was complete with liner notes.
Yes, I was going to mention the liner notes. I remember them. Like, they were very descriptive and like why you chose each song and like parts of the song that you liked and why you thought I might like it. And it was very thoughtful.
Well, thank you. So it worked.
Yeah, it worked.
Okay, that was it. That was the one. You were on the fence, but then you got the mix CD and it's like, oh, this is great.
Well, I will say I knew. I'm like, oh, he really likes me.
Guilty. Here we are. Well, all right. Look, well, we're talking CDs. We're talking Chicago history. And, you know, we're talking 16 years of just wedded bliss.
Okay, I will say one thing, though. I don't think I have been on the show since, like, the first 2 years, outside of being on the intro. So it's been a while since you've had me back.
I know. We've had a lot of fan mail saying that they want you back.
Yeah.
So this is the moment.
This is it.
Okay. This is it. Well, happy anniversary.
Happy anniversary.
Yay, love. And yay, you being here for the show today. I love listening to music, and I grew up during a time when vinyl was starting to fade, like in the 1990s, and CDs, compact discs, were on the rise. Eventually, CDs were everywhere. Then came the 2000s with the rise of iTunes and streaming services. CD sales dropped, and honestly, I didn't mind because I had my trusty iPod with me. Well, here we are living in the future right now, and yeah, vinyl has made a comeback for sure, but also so have CDs. Lower costs, DIY accessibility, and grassroots enthusiasm have all played a role in their resurgence. Lior Galil is a staff writer at the Chicago Reader, and recently he wrote a great piece called The Compact Disc Isn't Going Quietly. We could check out that piece at chicagoreader.com. Lior is here with us today on Outside the Loop. Lior, great to talk to you, man.
Thanks for having me.
You got it. So, you know, I'm just like flashing back here to the 90s when I think I joined the BMG Music Club and I got, you know, you pay a penny and you get 10 CDs and then you get, eventually, I think you get scammed and you have to pay a bunch of money. But you, I got a lot of CDs is the point here. And, you know, you write here in this piece, you start off by saying back in June, the Chicago Independent Radio Project, which is a great independent radio station on the north side, they hosted its third CD blowout sale. They raised $5,000 from that. So one thing I noticed in this piece, and I'd like you to kind of speak to this, the theme that people really seem to be excited. It goes back to this kind of grassroots enthusiasm that I mentioned. That's really a thing when it comes to CDs today, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's as much as there's a kind of newfound interest in CDs, it's kind of the, you know, it's the underdog in physical music media right now. Tapes and vinyl have both had, you know, a wellspring of popularity over the course of the past 15, 20 years or so. And CDs have always been kind of kicked to the side during a lot of that. And so it's a vintage format now. It's slightly obscure, so it has like a little bit of cool in that regard too. Mm-hmm. And because it is kind of fallen out of favor in so many ways, and it's not you know, as embraced by mainstream society, it's taken on this kind of sheath of cool, and it's inexpensive. So all this has kind of come together to make CDs seem different and novel and exciting in a way that, you know, vinyl had previously, and in a way that tapes had previously.
It's all kind of cyclical, I suppose. I mean, you mentioned vinyl. Yeah, that we've seen that come back and still very popular. But I think a few years ago, the story was kind of CDs are dying, or as you were saying, kind of pushed to the wayside. And I mean, you think about new cars today, most of those cars don't have CD players built in. And for a long time, that was just industry standard now. So in terms of why we're seeing this resurgence happen here, I mean, I'm thinking about my car. My one car is, I guess, 10, 11 years old. That has a CD player. My car that's from 5 years ago doesn't. So what's happening here? I mean, we talked a little bit about, okay, there's some enthusiasm, grassroots, but like, can we point to like one thing specifically about the resurgence, why this is happening?
Sure. I mean, I think the interest in it is still kind of an underground phenomenon. I mean, there have been pockets of music subcultures that never gave up on the CD, noise and experimental scenes and jazz. I mean, the format really works well for musical acts that take up a lot of room that, you know, it doesn't make sense to listen to a 40-minute suite on a record that you got to flip over. So that's always maintained there. But part of, I think, what we're witnessing now is not CDs as a huge cultural phenomenon in the way that every single person who wants to listen to music is experiencing it through a CD. It is it's a little more niche, and that niche has grown significantly enough that record stores, where, you know, diehard music fans go to experience music and engage with it, are noticing a complete switch in how folks who are buying music are engaging with it and what formats they're going for. I do think that the inaccessibility of it now, the work you got to do to listen to it, mm-hmm. is kind of a drive. I mean, that is what, you know, when people have praised vinyl in recent years and praised cassettes, it's like, you know, it's, you got to work for it a little bit. I think all of physical media, when you're engaging with it, encourages you, you know, the listener, or, you know, if you're watching Blu-ray or VHS, it encourages you to go a little further than streaming. I think all physical media right now, there's always going to be this this interest in it as a reaction to how most people are experiencing media in general, which is, you know, it's on your phone, it's on a tablet, it's passive. And so what we're witnessing now is just kind of a shift in the behaviors and the purchasing behaviors and collecting behaviors of people who never gave up on physical media or interested in physical media or interested in music beyond a passive consumer putting on Spotify.
There must be people out there with old CD players, or we must be able to get CD players. I mean, computers these days don't even have a CD DVD drive anymore. That used to be standard. So if we want to listen to a CD, like you're saying, we got to work for it. But people are doing that, aren't they?
Yeah. And there's, you know, one part that I didn't touch upon in my story is the K-pop acts have always been releasing music on CD. K-pop is a huge phenomenon, obviously, in Korea and internationally. And there's a huge audience for K-pop in the US. And there are K-pop branded CD players. They're flimsy as hell. They're not built for an audiophile, but mm-hmm. if you want a cheap option that has like a built-in speaker that, you know, it plays the music for you, you can get like a $40 K-pop CD player, K-pop branded CD player off the internet. There is an emergence of a kind of like a Walkman style CD player that, you know, you can connect to a stereo and that has Bluetooth enabled, and those run like north of $100. There's no like strictly Walkman style CD player at the moment, or CD stereo for an audiophile person. One of the co-owners of Tornlight Records in Wicker Park, Bucktown, who is a huge CD fan, was telling me that the thing that's missing is a stereo that audiophiles can enjoy that is available for consumers, for casual consumers, that is, you know, less expensive than the $300 to $500 audiophile CD deck. Personally, my CD deck that I've been using was a 5-disc changer that I got for, you know, $36 at a used record store in Michigan. It broke earlier this year, and I actually had to like break it apart to retrieve the CDs that were stuck in it. You can find used CD players in the same way that you can find used record players and used cassette players. Having a newer model that is more durable than, you know, a cheap one disc K-pop branded CD player is kind of the missing piece right now.
I remember I think it was the Iowa brand, AIWA. It was the 5-disc turntable thing too. And I had that from like 2000 to like 2013, 15, something around there. Then finally I had to jackhammer it open. But with the audio quality argument, I think that's interesting, because one of the things that I've heard from real kind of audiophile people is that, well, you know, I'm so upset that people are listening to this great music on these little tinny phone speakers, even though it's very easy to do because it's so portable. And with a CD player, you have some sort of bigger speaker situation. Now, of course, you can Bluetooth your phone. I get that. But is that kind of what we're getting at here?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can even with our phones, we can connect them to a stereo if you really rig them up. But CDs, I mean, the audio quality for CDs is great. I know a lot of people appreciate vinyl for the, you know, the warmth that it has. And I certainly do. That's also what I appreciate about cassettes. I collect, you know, music in whatever medium it is available to me. And I'm particularly interested in CDs in the same way that I'm interested in cassettes and vinyl from previous eras, that it is an archival tool for music that came out during that specific era that it was in vogue that maybe hasn't been available since then. That's something that I wasn't able to really touch upon in the article. But, you know, the CD collection, if you're a CD collector, there are CDs out there that are obscure, that aren't haven't been reissued from, you know, the 90s and early 2000s, that sell for hundreds of dollars because the material's just not available otherwise.
Right.
Audio quality is the CD has great audio quality. And if you are a musician who's recording stuff now, if you're not recording and mastering your music for vinyl, you're just mastering it digitally. It's whether or not it's on CD or vinyl or cassette, it kind of matches the CD format best in that regard.
You did, for your piece up at chicagoreader.com, talk to some local artists. You mentioned that you're talking to record folks in Wicker Park and Bucktown, but you say a lot of the younger musicians are putting their music on CDs, and there's kind of this like DIY ability now. Is that because like we're seeing, hey, you could have a fancy-ish kind of studio set up at home and you could just throw this stuff on CD and then distribute it on your own? Is that, which I remember like in the 2000s, that was a huge thing when people started to burn their own CDs. Is that coming back?
Yeah. And I mean, I don't think it ever really disappeared. That was part of the appeal for cassettes when, you know, there was a newfound interest in cassettes in the late 2000s, starting the late 2000s. Cassettes require way more work to you know, duplicate at home. CDs, you could just burn them on a computer. It's, you know, it offers folks who want to do things themselves quicker and cheaper option than cassettes, because cassettes are a little more expensive than CDs. You can get a pack of CDRs for next to nothing still. If you are a young musician who wants to do things yourself and you don't have a lot of financial recourse and you want to put something out physically, CDs do give you that option. And there is that leg up over cassettes in that regard. And again, you know, the sound is better for CDs than cassettes. If you're looking for a clean vibrancy there.
So what's up with vinyl? Because vinyl has been all the rage over the last few years. And I admit I love the big artwork in those liner notes. They're kind of like books. But is that popularity of vinyl starting to plateau a little bit? What's happening there?
I mean, it has plateaued a little bit, but there's still interest in popularity in vinyl. It's more expensive. It's increasingly expensive. A new vinyl record will run, you know, in some cases, minimum $30. In other cases, you know, labels and artists will sell them for $50, you know, north of $50. That's unreasonable if you are somebody on a budget who is also interested in buying a lot of music. If your options are a $36, album or the $15 CD version, like I'm going to get the CD version. It still offers all the stuff that's in the vinyl record. It still has liner notes. I've been buying CD box sets for years because that was the affordable option. I could still get the liner notes. I could also handle the liner notes in a little more manageable way than, you know, the big honking inserts in a vinyl record. Right. So it still has the audience. Musicians are still interested in putting out in vinyl. It has kind of a gilded sensibility to it. Like that is like you've kind of made it in some way. But if it's not everyone is that precious about how they're putting out music. If you have the financial wherewithal to do it, that's obviously, and nothing's preventing you from putting out a record, that's great. But you know, on the musician side, on the label side, the wait for pressing a record, at particularly right after the pandemic or right in the middle of the pandemic, you could wait a year or more to get your record pressed. So bands were doing pre-orders for a record that would come out physically months in advance. That's changed a little bit in the past few years, but there's still waits on those. I'll still see labels and bands being like, we were told we were going to get the record. It's coming soon. It's coming in a few weeks. There have been XYZ delays, and you don't see that with CDs. Certainly.
We've mentioned cassettes a few times in this conversation. I do remember the good old days of mixtapes. Those were a little bit more complicated to make because if you screwed up, you might have to start the whole thing over. But where are we with cassettes? Are they still a thing? Are bands releasing music on cassette still?
Yeah, they're still a thing. I think about one of the breakout acts from Chicago the past few years is Sharp Pins, which is led by Kai Slater from Lifeguard, which is another big breakout indie rock band from mm-hmm. Chicago. And Sharp Pins, Kai first released his music under that name on cassette a few years ago. But yeah, young people again are still releasing music on cassette. I don't think it's like dwindled in any sense because the kind of audience and interest in that was always going to be marginal. But that's, you know, I think the format still gives people who are interested in what the cassette can offer, which is it's compact, it's portable, it has a hissing warmth. You can kind of do things yourself. It does give you a little more DIY cachet than a CDR. And again, I think we're at a period where after, you know, the digital, the, you know, the introduction of MP3s and streaming as a kind of a all consuming force in music, all formats, all physical formats, with the exception of shellac 78 RPM records, which you just can't really get made anywhere, and 8-track tapes, which there still is some new music pressed to 8-track, you know, and mini disc. I don't think anyone's really rocking with mini disc right now. Not that they were. I had a mini disc player.
I still do.
In middle school. That's incredible.
I still have it. It works.
I mean, I think, you know, mini disc was particularly for people in our field kind of heralded as this great tool for recording, which it was. I mean, it that's the audience for it. So, you know, but the you know, cassettes and records and CDs were massive consumer tools for experiencing music in the way that mini disc and 8-track wasn't. And, you know, shellac was part of the introduction of vinyl. But yeah, I mean, I all physical media for experiencing music and, you know, for film and television has an audience. When that audience gets big enough to get attention outside of those communities, that's kind of that, those inflection points are interesting to me, which is what I experienced with, you know, writing about the CD, because I'm not a CD diehard. I do have a lot of CDs and I listen to music on CDs, but I'm not like, this is the format for me. I'm like, this is an interesting moment for CDs.
Well, this is really inspired me to go into my basement and dig out all of my CDs that are in storage somewhere. I put them all, you know, in digital form, but I'm going to get back to the CDs. I'm excited for this. We could check out this piece called The Compact Disc Isn't Going Quietly on chicagoreader.com. We will link up to it. But Lior Galil is the staff writer for the Chicago Reader, and he wrote about the compact disc and its resurgence. And it's always been here, but maybe we're paying a little bit more attention to it. Hey, Lior, I really enjoyed reading this. I'm sure everyone else will as well. And I appreciate the time today, man.
Yeah, thank you for thinking of me. I really appreciate talking to you.
Understanding of history is impacted by where we start the story. For example, in Chicago, a lot of us know that the Great Chicago Fire of 1871, in a way, paved for the rebuilding of the city as a metropolitan powerhouse that it's become today. But what was life like before the Chicago Fire? Louis P. Kane answers this question in his new book called Chicago Before the Fire: An Economic History. In addition to being an author, he's an adjunct professor of economics at Northwestern University and a professor emeritus at Loyola University, Chicago. In his new deeply researched book, Kane takes us back to the city's early days, long before the Great Chicago Fire of 1871, to explore how a muddy, remote settlement on the lakefront grew into a thriving economic hub. It's a fascinating look at Chicago's rise. And Louis P. Kane is with us today on Outside the Loop. Lou, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here. So, okay, this book, there is a lot of information in this book, and I think it's really interesting. It's a fascinating look into this history that maybe a lot of us aren't, you know, quite familiar with. So I just want to ask you up front, you know, we talk a lot about the story of the Great Chicago Fire and beyond. So why did you want to focus specifically on what was happening before 1871 in Chicago?
Well, there's several reasons. The people who are writing about Chicago after the fire typically use the Phoenix rising from the ashes as the symbol of their period. And as far as I could always tell as an economist, as an economic historian, the fire was just a brief interruption. The city was back to work within days and was rebuilding almost immediately. And the fire was a short interruption. maybe even less than COVID.
Wow. So that, and again, I think that's interesting because you're right. I don't think we talk about it like that. It was this awful event, but the recovery was pretty quick after it. So, all right, take us back to around 1837. So the city is founded March 4th, 1837. What was life like in Chicago? Can you just broadly give us an idea of how things were happening here around that time when Chicago was officially incorporated?
It's a very short period of time from when the fur trade sort of departs the city and the city incorporates as a village. That's 1833. Mm-hmm. And then 4 years later, it's a city. That tells you something about how fast it's growing. And the growth is basically the result of the notion that there's going to be a canal built between Lake Michigan and the Illinois River, connecting these two bodies of water, and thereby opening up the Mississippi Valley to traffic from Lake Michigan, with Chicago right in the middle. And so people are coming in droves, speculating on the land, if nothing else. But also, there are people who are willing to take a chance on themselves and sell things to these speculators and others that are showing up in the city.
Yeah, location. You talk a lot about location in this book. And Chicago really benefits from where we're located here, right on Lake Michigan. But also you're talking about now trying to connect certain bodies of water. So location with the fur trade and eventually I know with meatpacking, location is a big part of the story that really benefits the Chicago area, right?
The fact is that just downstream from the mouth of the Chicago River is the lowest divide between the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River water systems. And the idea was, we'll cross that with a canal. And the Illinois and Michigan Canal did that, but that same divide is where we built several railroads, where the Stevenson Expressway runs today. That divide is what really is the location that defined Chicago.
Talking about location here, something that you bring up in this book, looking at this pre-Chicago fire history, is the sanitation issue. And we all know that eventually we reversed the flow of the Chicago River for sanitary reasons. And that's an amazing engineering feat. You talk about that in the book. But early on, The sanitation issue, partly because of geography here, leads to innovation. Like there are strides early on in the city's history where we talk about, okay, we've got this mud problem. I said this is a muddy area. So the people in Chicago early on are trying to kind of work through this. So that's a big part of the story, too. You know, we talk about the reversal of the river, but really before that, there's a lot of innovation happening, and that matters, doesn't it?
The fact is that Chicago is located on a glacial lake bed. The ground was meant to hold water, not to absorb it. A rain would lead to mud. And there were all kinds of stories about the mud back before they did anything about drainage. My favorite being that two ladies came out of a store in downtown Chicago and saw the commandant of Fort Dearborn in his dress uniform up to his waist in mud. And they asked him, "Are you okay?" And he said, "Yes, but I'm a little bit worried about the horse I'm riding." And that had to be solved. And lots of things were tried. One of the first public works after Chicago became incorporated was they built a drainage ditch. But the city was so flat that that enabled water to come into the city as opposed to taking any water out.
So yeah, that's an example of, you know, the efforts, right? So this innovation is born in part out of necessity. We want to solve some of these problems. And that kind of takes us into some of the visionaries that you talk about here. And some of these names are familiar to maybe a bunch of us here who have lived in this area our entire lives. People like Cyrus McCormick, George Pullman, Potter Palmer, Marshall Field. And all of these guys, I mean, they're known for different things, and they're very important in the advancement of Chicago, both economically, you could say socially, in the business field as well, technology. Is there someone that I didn't just mention there that you cover in the book that you think is worthy of just mentioning, hey, this person did something important, someone not on that list that I mentioned? Is anybody come to you the front of your mind?
Well, based on the need to deal with the mud, the name Ellis Sylvester Chesbro, the city engineer, is the one person who was responsible for finding solutions. And not just for the drainage, but also for waste disposal and water supply. When we finally put in sewers that went out into the lake and began to pollute the water supply, which is a big problem for any city located on a freshwater lake. They tend to use the lake for both waste disposal and water supply. And that interdependency is something that has to be dealt with.
And he's the guy. I mean, he's the engineer when we talk about the reversal of the river, but also the problems that you just mentioned. He's really instrumental in solving or helping to solve those problems. And he might not be a name that a lot of us know, but he's someone that we should really kind of hold up in a way in the pantheon of historic Chicagoans.
Yes, absolutely. He was hired from Boston to devise a sewerage strategy. And Chicago was the first major U.S. city to have a comprehensive sewer system. Lots of cities had sewers, you know, that went from here to there and all around, but no coordination. And he's the one that had a coordinated system for the whole city. And Chicago was the first to do that because they needed it.
You know, looking at the history here, again, this book, Chicago Before the Fire and Economic History, there is a lot of information in this book. Is there a turning point or a moment where the rest of the country really knows that Chicago was becoming this economic powerhouse? Was it kind of a slow growth or a slow burn? Or was there a moment where the rest of the country says, okay, it's maybe we should give some respect to this place because they're right on the water, they have resources, businesses are there, people are there. Was there a moment, or was it more of like a slow build over time on our way to this powerhouse status?
Well, I don't know if you could use the word slow, given that in 1830, Chicago was like 100 people, and in 1870, it's 325,000. I think that the event that comes to my mind is an 1845 Rivers and Harbors Convention that was the first big event that was held in Chicago. And all kinds of famous people came. And that's probably the first time that many of them had set foot in Chicago. 3 years later, we have the canal opened, the first railroad to run out of the city, the first telegraph message coming in. And at that point, Chicago begins to be integrated with the rest of the country. It's not this far little dot at the corner of Lake Michigan that's inaccessible all winter.
There's a lot of info in this book, like I've been saying, and not only the text, but also charts. You've got pictures. In terms of your work researching this, how did you go about this? Because there is a level of detail in this book that is very precise. There is a lot of context that you provide. how did you go about researching this? Where did you look?
Well, the first thing to say is, when you introduce me, you use the word emeritus, which suggests that I've been at this a long, long time.
Right.
And in fact, the first deep foray I made into Chicago history was as part of my doctoral dissertation. And I've been at it ever since. I've come back to do projects that involve Chicago history throughout my career. So I had a lot of stuff accumulated from various projects that cover decades.
So that's helpful for you, having been at this a long time, as you say, constantly researching, digging into archives and the history that maybe we don't know a lot about, just generally speaking. And I know that historians don't always love this question, but I have to ask it here, Lou. If the Great Chicago Fire doesn't happen, because your book takes us up to the Chicago Fire, if that event doesn't happen, is it even possible to guess, to postulate how Chicago evolves if the Chicago Fire doesn't happen? What is the future of Chicago at that point?
I think Chicago was set back months, but it's hard to tell what would have happened otherwise. The big changes that take place are that before the fire, the main street of downtown is Lake Street, parallel to the river. Mm-hmm. After the fire, it becomes State Street, thanks to Potter Palmer. Is that going to change anything with respect to where people are coming from, where people are going to, what products are being produced? No. I think that Chicago probably would have been the same regardless of the fire, just like, you know, many other cities that experienced fires.
Hmm. Well, this book is fascinating. A lot of information in here. We have just glanced the surface of this. There's a lot more in this book. The book is called Chicago Before the Fire, An Economic History. It's available wherever we get our books. This is published by the University of Illinois Press, and it really is a fascinating look at Chicago's rise. And Louis P. Kane is the author of the book. He is a professor of economics at Northwestern University and a professor emeritus at Loyola University Chicago. Lou, congratulations on this book. We should all pick it up, especially for all of the Chicago history buffs out there. And thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you, Mike.
And that'll do it. Outside the Loop, show number 981 is done. Thank you so much for listening to the show today. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for all of his massive engineering skills in the WGN Radio studio. I hope you have a wonderful week. I will talk to you again next time, right here on Outside the Loop.